The 2006 International AIDS Conference, Time to Deliver, brought to you by KaiserNetwork.org.
My co-chair, it is a pleasure and honor to welcome you to this session on novel targets for drug development. I'm Isaac Adewale from Nigeria. And we have three speakers for this important session. Each speaker will speak for 25 minutes and will take questions for 5 minutes. And that will lead us to 1.5 hours for the three speakers. I'm going to set the ball rolling by inviting the first speaker, Dr. Warner Green, who is a professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. He's also the founding director of the Gladstone Institute of Virology and Immunology. The Gladstone Institute is a research center dedicated to the study of modern virology and immunology with a focus on HIV/AIDS. Dr. Green has degrees from Stanford University, the Washington University School of Medicine, and has served as an investigator at the National Cancer Center and the Duke University Medical Center. The subject of Dr. Green's presentation today is cell virus interactions as targets for drug development.
Thank you very much. Allow me to offer my thanks to the organizers of the meeting for this opportunity to present. So what I'd like to talk about today is the VIF-APOBEC 3G axis as a new target for anti-HIV drug development. Each of us in this room produces a potent innate antiviral factor that can potentially stop HIV dead in its tracks. That factor, of course, is APOBEC 3G. So what is APOBEC 3G? A very odd-sounding name. It is a 46 kilodalton innate or intrinsic antiviral factor that is active not only against HIV, but a range of human retroviruses. It is a cytidine deaminase that belongs to a larger family of RNA editing and DNA mutator enzymes, including the prototypical members of this family, APOBEC1 and AID, which is involved in B-cell biology. It has been believed that virion incorporation was proposed to be a prerequisite for its antiviral activity, although, as I'll show you later today, that is not always the case. So APOBEC 3G is incorporated into the budding virion by interactions with the HIV RNA as well as the nucleocapsid protein of the virus. The inclusion of APOBEC 3G in that virion renders it non-infectious. And the mechanism involves the process of reverse transcription in the next cell. As the minus strand DNA is made, the deoxycytidines present in that strand are deaminated by APOBEC 3G, converting them into deoxyuridine. The deoxyuridine then leads either to attempts at non-templated DNA repair, which lead to strand cleavage, or if second strand synthesis as a part of reverse transcription proceeds, there is the introduction of G to A hypermutations, which may close down open reading frames or alter protein coding sequence. So in view of the very potent antiviral properties of APOBEC 3G, why, in fact, are we witnessing a global HIV epidemic? The reason is simple. The reason is that because HIV devotes one of its nine distinct gene products, the VIF gene, to neutralizing or circumventing the activity of APOBEC 3G. VIF, as you know, is a protein that is expressed late in the retroviral cycle in a Rev-dependent manner. Of course, the question is, how does VIF overcome or defeat the antiviral activities of APOBEC 3G? We now know, in part through the studies of a graduate student in my laboratory, Kim Stopak. Kim was able to show that VIF has two particular actions. One, that VIF can bind to APOBEC 3G and accelerate the degradation of this antiviral factor in the 26S proteasome. In addition, VIF can moderately inhibit the synthesis of new APOBEC 3G protein. The combined effects lead to essentially the complete intracellular depletion of APOBEC 3G. Thus, there's no antiviral factor to be incorporated into the budding virion, and those virions remain fully infectious. Subsequently, it was shown by a number of colleagues in the field that, in fact, VIF achieves this degradation of APOBEC3G by recruiting a specific E3 ligase complex that mediates the polyubiquitination of APOBEC3G. Now, of course, understanding a molecular basis by which VIF targets APOBEC3G for... I think I'll just push through. VIF binds to APOBEC3G, so in essence, now we have a potential target for future antiviral drug discovery. The interaction now is becoming known in greater molecular detail. We know that the N-termini of both VIF and APOBEC3G are interacting. And we know that a single amino acid mutation or a single acid change or substitution at position 128 can completely change the specificity by whether APOBEC3G binds HIV VIF or the VIF of a particular monkey virus. So indeed, much is being learned, and it is interesting to consider the possibilities of trying to interfere with this interface, thereby protecting the intracellular levels of APOBEC3G, allowing APOBEC3G to be incorporated into the virion, where it will successfully hypermutate the virus and essentially kill the replication cycle. I guess that's next door, so I just need to speak right over there. Okay. So here's a graph of that. So VIF binding to APOBEC3G. This leads, of course, to the proteasome degradation. The idea is by high-throughput screening techniques to identify small molecules that block the assembly of VIF with APOBEC3G or potentially the recruitment by VIF of the E3 ligase complex, which is necessary for the polyubiquitination of APOBEC3G. So this is an area that is of incredibly active in the field right now, as both academic labs and pharmaceutical companies are entering the high-throughput screening phase of this particular project, looking for those early hits that might lead to leads and that might ultimately be engineered into a new therapeutic class of anti-HIV medications. Now, as a part of our studies of APOBEC3G, we were intrigued by the fact that we understood that VIF was able to defeat APOBEC3G intravirion incorporation, as shown here. This virus contains no intravirion APOBEC3G, but every time it infects a target cell, it is entering an environment that is completely laden with APOBEC3G. So why is that cytoplasmic APOBEC3G not able to exert the same antiviral effect that is peculiarly associated with intravirion APOBEC3G? We wondered whether APOBEC might be subject to some form of negative regulation within cells. And two postdoctoral fellows, Yalin Chu and Vanessa Soros in the laboratory, undertook these studies. And what they in fact found was that APOBEC3G is recruited into a very high molecular mass complex, about 5 to 15 megadaltons, much, much larger in size than a single monomer or dimer of the enzyme. However, if you treated this high molecular mass complex of APOBEC3G with RNAs, now it disassembled into what a low molecular mass form, which in fact was consistent in size with monomers or dimers of the enzyme. Furthermore, when you assay these two forms of APOBEC3G for enzymatic activity, their ability to deaminate deoxycytidine residues, one finds that the high molecular mass form of APOBEC is incapable or it lacks such enzymatic activity, whereas the RNase-treated low molecular mass form of APOBEC3G is fully active in this enzymatic assay. Thus, it appears that APOBEC3G is inactivated in activated T cells, for example, because it is recruited into these high molecular mass complexes and the intrinsic cytidine deaminase activity is inhibited, apparently in part by its association with RNA. Now, this recognition of both high and low molecular mass APOBEC complexes also led us to be able to solve a 20-year riddle in HIV biology, and that riddle is, why is HIV completely unable to infect the resting CD4 T cell? It turns out that APOBEC3G, again, is a player in this story. Previously, it was thought that resting T cells are not infected by HIV because they simply lack key factors necessary for viral replication. However, what I'll show you now is, in fact, is that these resting CD4 T cells are actually projecting a powerful antiviral defense in the form of APOBEC3G in the low molecular mass form, which unfortunately is forfeited when the T cell becomes activated and APOBEC3G is swept up into the high molecular mass complex. So indeed, when we looked at resting CD4 T cells, we found that the APOBEC3G fractionated almost exclusively in the low molecular mass form, but when one activates these CD4 T cells with mitogens or cytokines like PHA and IL-2, we see that the majority of the APOBEC3G now resides in the high molecular mass complex. These cells are highly resistant to HIV infection. These cells are highly permissive to HIV infection. But indeed, we needed to show that by knocking down the expression of APOBEC3G in the resting CD4 T cell, that we could render these cells permissive to HIV infection to really prove the hypothesis. So we took siRNAs, we nucleofected the siRNAs into these resting CD4 T cells, and then challenged these cells with HIV, a reporter virus, that where we could measure infection by surface expression of heat-stable antigen. And so evidence of successful infection of the challenge population is indicated by flow events occurring in the boxed area. So unstimulated resting CD4 T cells, highly resistant to HIV infection. However, if you activate these cells with PHA and IL-2, they are very permissive to HIV infection. If, in fact, you introduce a mismatched siRNA, one that does not effectively knock down APOBEC3G expression, the cells remain highly resistant to HIV infection. However, if one decreases the expression of HIV of APOBEC3G, one now sees that one can render the resting CD4 T cells permissive to HIV infection. Thus, we would submit that, in fact, that the low molecular mass form of APOBEC3G, which probably is a monomer or dimer of the enzyme, functions as a very powerful post-entry restriction factor in resting CD4 T cells. Of note, this particular action of APOBEC3G is not countered by VIF because there's little or no VIF in the virion, and the cell and the virus has not progressed far enough into its life cycle to make new VIF protein. So this low molecular mass post-entry block of APOBEC3G is equally effective against wild type as well as delta VIF forms of the virus. However, this potent post-entry block is lost when the T cell becomes activated or monocytes differentiate into macrophages because APOBEC3G now is recruited into this high molecular mass complex, thus opening the door to HIV infection. The vast majority of HIV infections are, of course, occurring in resting CD4 T cells, but these are abortive infections because of the potent activity of APOBEC3G. The virus explicitly exploits the window of opportunity created by the recruitment of APOBEC3G into this high molecular mass complex to now be able to infect only the activated population of cells. So this really raised in our mind, what is this high molecular mass APOBEC complex? What is its function within cells? Something important must be going on here because, in fact, it's the production of these complexes, of course, makes the cells so vulnerable to HIV infection. So we went about purifying all of the protein components of the high molecular mass complex by tandem affinity purification. This is shows the Kumasi stain. Each of these, this entire gel was now sectioned, and mass spec was done on each of the protein bands and led to tandem mass spec and led to the identification of more than 95 proteins present in this high molecular mass complex. So indeed, this is a list. I'll not go through them, but it was an amazing list of a variety of different proteins. And when we looked at this particular ensemble of proteins, we wondered whether it corresponded to some known potential ribonucleoprotein complex. And indeed, the answer was yes. In fact, this complex of proteins is what is called a Stoffen-containing RNA transport granule. So one might, first thing I asked, well, what's a Stoffen RNA transport granule? So indeed, these are greater than 10 megadalton complexes, which play a key role in the localization and regulated translation of specific messenger RNAs. They have been best studied in Drosophila and mouse neurons. For example, in a mouse neuron, when a synapse is activated, these transporting, these somfen transporting granules move to the site of electrical stimulation, and their mRNAs are selectively translated there, which leads to changes in synaptic plasticity, which underlies a lot of what we now recognize as learning and memory. So then this raised the issue, okay, well, in these CD4 T cells, what are the RNAs that are present in this high molecular mass APOBEC3G complex? Well, in fact, the stunning finding was that we found two retrotransposons, or mobile genetic element RNAs, present in this high molecular mass APOBEC complex. So let me digress for a moment to speak about retrotransposons and the APOBECs. So it's well known that retrotransposons, jumping genes, if you will, that the activity of these retrotransposons is 100-fold less in humans than it is in mice. Mice contain a single APOBEC3 gene. However, humans and primates contain 8 APOBEC3 genes, which have been increased in number by tandem duplication over evolution. And these APOBEC genes also have undergone significant striking evolution, non-synonymous mutation, suggesting that there's been a strong selective pressure driving their evolution. And indeed, we would suggest, as have others, that these changes were evident prior to the emergence of the primate lentiviruses, suggesting that wasn't the driving force, but rather could the APOBECs in fact be involved in limiting retrotransposon activity in higher primates and in humans. If one looks at the family of transposable elements, one can see the DNA transposons and the retrotransposons. The retrotransposons can be divided into those that contain long-terminal repeats and those that lack long-terminal repeats. The LTR-containing retrotransposons are the endogenous retroviruses. In humans, there are no currently active endogenous retroviruses. Amongst the non-LTR retrotransposons are these long interspersed nucleotide elements called line elements, which are autonomous. They encode their own reverse transcriptase and endonuclease. But then there's the non-autonomous short interspersed nucleotide elements. These are insufficient. They do not encode their own reverse transcriptase and endonuclease, but borrow these enzymes from the line elements in order to achieve their retrotransposition. The most common sign element or non-autonomous element is, in fact, the ALU element. So there have been a whole variety of studies that I'll not review because of time today, implicating various members of this 8-membered family of the APOBECs in controlling endogenous retroviruses in the mouse system, line 1 elements, etc. Of note, APOBEC3G had never been shown to be involved in the regulation of any of these, of line 1 elements or short interspersed nucleotide elements or endogenous human retroviruses. In fact, the first RNA that we found in the high molecular mass complex was, in fact, ALU RNA. So this is, I mentioned, one of the most successful human retrotransposons. ALU elements form 10.5% of our entire human genome. New ALU retrotransposition events occur at least in one in every 100 births, but it's been, as I mentioned, this appears to be decreasing in frequency over the last 40 to 50 million years of evolution. And ALU can mediate both insertional and post-insertional mutagenic events. So, in fact, we found the ALUs. We found both the primary ALU element shown on the left as well as the small cytoplasmic form of ALU. The second type of RNA identified in this high molecular mass APOBEC complex was, again, another non-autonomous retroelement termed small y RNAs. So these represent a novel class of line 1-dependent non-autonomous retrotransposable elements. All four of these Y elements were identified within the APOBEC 3G high molecular mass complex. So shown here is the purification of the high molecular mass and amplification of ALU as well as HY1 RNA from that complex. If one purifies the Stoffen RNA granule in the absence of APOBEC 3G, you do not find these endogenous retroelements. However, if you provide APOBEC 3G and trans, now suddenly ALU and HY are recruited to the Stoffen-containing RNA granule, suggesting the possibility that APOBEC may be specifically recognizing these retroelements and guiding them to the Stoffen-containing RNA granule. turns out that there's about a 20 to 100-fold enrichment of ALU and HY RNAs within these Stoffen RNA granules. If you compare the RNA signal intensity derived from the granule versus that present in the cytoplasm. However, these granules do not, they're not promiscuous binders of all kinds of RNAs, because if looking at a whole variety of cellular RNAs, we in fact find no evidence that these RNAs are present in the Stoffen RNA granule. So another point was that in fact these ALU elements or HY elements were not particularly expressed in the resting CD4 T cell, but all of the protein components of the Stoffen RNA granule were present in the resting CD4 T cell. But when one activates, for example, with pH and IL-2, one turns on the expression of these retrotransposon RNAs, and we suggest that, in fact, that these are the nucleating factors that drive high molecular mass assembly, likely by their docking with APOBEC3G and recruitment into the Stoffen-containing RNA granule. We then use to prove that in fact, APOBEC3G is involved in counter-regulating ALU retrotransposition. We collaborated with the Heidman Laboratory in France, used a marked ALU retrotransposition assay. I'll not go through the details of this particular assay, but it's really a fascinating assay that allows you to detect ALU retrotransposition events by the selection of G418-resistant colonies. And in fact, what we found is the presence of APOBEC3G had profound inhibitory effects upon ALU retrotransposition. And indeed, so that in fact you can see dose-related effects of APOBEC3G and wild-type APOBEC3G inhibiting ALU retrotransposition. And in addition, non-catalytic or non-enzymatically active versions of APOBEC3G also exerted the same type of inhibition against this ALU retrotransposition. Indeed, we propose that the mechanism it's not a hypermutation of the ALU RNA, but instead it's a sequestration of ALU and HY RNAs in the cytoplasm in these Stoffen RNA granules, which denies access of the ALU and HY elements to the nuclear line 1 elements and the machinery provided by the line 1 elements necessary for the completion of the reverse transcription of the ALU and HY retrotransposons. And in fact, we can show that the marked ALU retrotransposable RNA, the marked ALU element, is in fact recruited to the APOBEC3G high molecular mass complex. It's not recruited to the Stoffen RNA granule. But if you purify Stoffen in the presence of APOBEC3G expressed in trans, one can now see ALU successfully recruited to the high molecular mass complex. So let me just summarize these findings by saying that in the resting CD4 T cell, APOBEC3G exists in this low molecular mass form, which exerts a very potent post-entry restriction activity against HIV. The reason, at least a major reason, why resting CD4 T cells are not successfully infected by this retrovirus. However, when in fact now CD4 T cells are activated, several things happen. One now begins to express these endogenous mobile genetic elements, including ALU and HY. The expression of these RNAs and their association with APOBEC3G now triggers the assembly of the high molecular mass APOBEC3G complex. And in fact, these complexes are forming to deal with the threat from within provided by these ALU and HY retrotransposable elements. Unfortunately, the fact that low molecular mass is swept up into the high molecular mass complex opens the door to HIV infection, allowing the full replication cycle of HIV to be completed. Now, one idea would be to come up with inhibitors that would now promote, either would block the recruitment of low molecular mass APOBEC into the high molecular mass complex, or would promote its disassembly. But of course, we don't want to completely block high molecular mass assembly, because we feel that it's performing an important function, but one would like to balance the high molecular mass and low molecular mass. If we could preserve low molecular mass APOBEC3G within the activated CD4 T cell, while at the same time having some level of high molecular mass APOBEC, we could confer upon activated CD4 T cells the same type of resistance that is so characteristic of activated, of resting CD4 T cells. So I'd like to conclude there. I'd like to thank the NIH, AMFAR, and the Center for AIDS Research and the University-wide AIDS Research Program for funding our studies on APOBEC3G, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have. Thank you for your attention.
Microphone number two. That's you, sir.
Oh, me, sir. Okay. Earlier in the presentation, you mentioned using the N-terminus of the VIF protein as a drug target, right? What would be, do we know yet what would the consequences would be if that turned out to be too hard and we use the N-terminus of the APOBEC3G protein as a drug target to prevent it from binding to VIF?
So I think the idea is that we know that the N-termini of these proteins interact, and the idea is to come up with small molecules that would prevent that interaction, which would leave APOBEC3G, it would no longer be targeted for degradation in the proteasome by APOBEC3G. So the idea is simply to try and protect APOBEC3G from the polyubiquitination and proteasome-mediated degradation executed by VIF binding to the N-terminus of APOBEC. But this is all going to be a small molecule approach, not a peptide approach, because, of course, ultimately we want to have an orally bioavailable drug that would be could be given to patients.
Thank you. We'll just have time for the two questioners that are at the mics now. We'll start with microphone number three, please.
Artis Mo, UCLA. Does your findings have any relationship to the blips seen in viral load when patients are given vaccinations, for example?
Well, certainly when they're given vaccination, there's a component of T cell activation which would now create more cells that are permissive to HIV infection. So that certainly could play a role.
And our final question from microphone number two, please.
Hi. When perhaps you said this, but when the APOBEC is in the high molecular weight complex, do you have any evidence yet that it's just sequestering those allo elements or whether it's actually editing them?
So there's no enzymatic activity of APOBEC in that complex, and we're sequencing the allo elements now to see if there's any editing, but we don't anticipate that. Furthermore, we can use mutants, enzymatically active mutants of APOBEC3G, recruit those into the high molecular mass, and they're completely effective as inhibitors of retrotransposition. So we don't think mutations involved.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Green. It's now my privilege to introduce Dr. Eric Cohen. He's a professor of virology at the Université de Montréal and serves as director of their Laboratory of Human Retrovirology. He holds a Canada Research Chair in Human Retrovirology. Dr. Cohen has degrees from McGill University and the Université de Montréal. He performed a postdoctoral fellowship at Harvard Medical School and has been involved in the study of HIV and AIDS since 1986. His research has led to the discovery of two HIV proteins. The question Dr. Cohen will be speaking to today is, can we identify novel virus-based targets? Dr. Cohen.
Thank you. I would like to thank the organizer for the invitation to participate to this symposium. What I would like to do today is focus my talk on the HIV host cell interaction that control the site, the choice of assembly and release during infection, and discuss the possibility of using these interactions as target for novel drug novel antiviral drugs. So HIV-1 assembly and budding is a sequential process that involves the targeting of structural viral component to a membrane assembly and budding site. GAG, the GAG precursor polyprotein precursor, plays a central role in this process, since expression of GAG without any other viral protein can direct the formation of viral particles. The GAG polyprotein precursor plays a central role and is cleaved by the viral protease during viral release and maturation, and consists of three assembly domains. The first domain is the M domain, which is very important for the targeting of GAG to the site of assembly and budding, and mediates GAG association to lipid membrane. The I domain mediates GAG multimerization, and the L domain mediates the last step of viral particle morphogenesis, that is the fission of the viral particle from membranes, by interacting with TSG101, a host cell protein that is involved in the formation of internal vesicles in a peculiar endosomal compartment called multivesicular bodies, or MVB. Indeed, through the work of Wes Sutquist and many others, HIV budding has been shown to rely on a very complex host cell machinery, which is devoted to the formation of internal vesicles, also in multivesicular bodies, called exosomes, and to the selection of cargo that need to be exocytosed from cells. GAG and interaction of GAG with TSG101 through a PTAP sequence in the leader sequence of in the L domain of GAG recruit a series of complex ESCRT1, ESCRT2, and ESCRT3, which direct the formation of viral particle and fission of viral particle in a process that is topologically very similar to the formation of exosomes. So although these ESCRT complex are required for viral production, it is unclear whether they perform their functions at the level of multivesicular bodies or at the plasma membrane or at both locations. In that regard, an intriguing feature of HIV-1 assembly is that different membrane can serve as platform for viral assembly in different cell types. For instance, in T lymphocytes or in most human transformed cell lines, the majority of GAG is targeted to the plasma membrane, although we can detect also some GAG in internal location. In contrast, in cells such as macrophages, HIV-1 bud mostly in intracellular compartments, and these intracellular compartments have been shown to correspond to multivesicular bodies since they expressed MVB markers, including MHC class 2, CD63, LAMP1, and LBPA, which is a lipid which is exclusively found in internal membranes of multivesicular bodies. However, the mechanism that controlled the choice of virus assembly and budding sign remained poorly understood. For instance, the precise routes by which GAG reaches its cell surface or MVB steady state accumulation is still unclear, and the host cell factors that control the choice of HIV budding sites are not entirely defined. So, what are the routes by which GAG reach its plasma membrane or multivesicular steady state accumulation? So several models can that do not need to be mutually exclusive can be advanced to really explain the accumulation of GAG at steady state in different cell types. In the first model, the site of GAG targeting, assembly and release is cell type dependent. In some cells, GAG will be targeted to the plasma membrane without any interaction with MVB. Whereas in cells such as macrophages, GAG will be targeted to MVBs where assembly and budding will occur. Virus release in the extracellular medium can proceed by a process of exocytosis, which is regulated in macrophages. In the second model, GAG is first targeted to multivesicular bodies in all cell types. MVB in cells such as lymphocytes, MVB-containing virus will be constitutively exocytosed, and so that at steady state, the majority of GAG will be located at the plasma membrane. In macrophages, GAG will accumulate in MVB since exocytosis is regulated. In a third model, GAG is targeted first at the plasma membrane, and GAG accumulation will result from a process of internalization from the cell membrane toward MVB by a process of endocytosis. And release of our protocol could proceed by exocytosis. So Andres Finzi, Alexandre Antoine, and Joan Mercier in my lab initiated studies to test these different models, and they okay. Is there a problem? Okay. So what they did was to follow the movement of GAG in 293 T cells, a cell type in which the majority of GAG is accumulating at the plasma membrane at steady state, but in which we can detect GAG also in internal compartment, in fact in MVBs. So they followed the dynamic movement of GAG by combining pulse chase labeling analysis with subcellular fractionation. So in order to locate GAG at different time intervals, they develop a subcellular fractionation assay using an OptiPEP gradient. So when they analyzed by electron microscopy the different fraction, they were able to show that in low density, can I go back please? One slide. Can I go back? Okay. So in low density fraction at the top of the gradient, they found that we were finding mostly plasma membrane, whereas at the bottom of the gradient in high density fraction, there was an enrichment of multilamellar and multivesicular structure that were very similar to MVBs. So we further characterized this fraction used by Western blot, and we could show that cell surface biotinylated proteins, transferrin receptor at 4 degrees, cell surface CD4, sodium potassium at TPAs, and an enzyme alkaline phosphatase were all detected in fraction at the top of the gradient. None of these markers, which are specific for the plasma membrane, were found at the bottom of the gradient. Conversely, when we tested markers of late endosomal and MVB, such as CD63, HLA-DR, LAMP1, and an enzyme beta-exoaminidase, we detected those markers in fraction in the middle of the gradient, but these markers were also enriched in fraction of high density in the bottom of the gradient. So using this subcellular fractionation, we followed the movement of GAG and GAG cleavage product in 293 T cells. After 10-minute labeling, the majority of GAG and GAG-associated product was associated with fraction that were associated with plasma membrane markers, and some GAG was also detected in the low-density fraction associated with MVB markers. Although GAG processing proceeded very efficiently in PM fractions, in plasma membrane fractions, it was clearly less efficient in the fraction that were associated with MVB markers. At 5 hours post labeling, most of the GAG associated with the plasma membrane fraction was efficiently processed and released in the extracellular medium. One interesting thing that we noticed was that between 30 minutes and 2 hours, we started detecting the accumulation of mature GAG product in the form of P24 in the MVB, in the fraction that were associated with multivesicular markers, likely from the result of an internalization process from the plasma membrane toward MVBs. This accumulation of P24 didn't seem to traffic back toward the plasma membrane and didn't seem to contribute to the release of extracellular virus. So to investigate further this accumulation of P24 over time, we treated cells with philippine, which is an inhibitor of endocytosis, and at the concentration of philippine that we've been using, both clatrin-dependent and caveolin-dependent endocytosis were inhibited, as measured by the internalization of labeled transferrin and labeled chlorotoxin. So in condition where cells were treated with philippin, we completely inhibited this accumulation of mature P24 that was present over time in fraction that were associated with multivesicular bodies, indicating that indeed this accumulation was the result of an internalization process by endocytosis. We further characterized this internalization by then treating cells with chlorpromazine, which is a drug that inhibits specifically clatrin-dependent endocytosis and that doesn't have any effect on caveolin-dependent endocytosis, as measured again by the internalization of labeled transferrin or labeled chlorotoxin. And in this condition, the chlorpromazine was not inhibiting at all the accumulation of this mature P24 in fraction that were associated with multivesicular bodies, suggesting that internalization of GAG from the plasma membrane to MVB involve an endocytosis process that is clatrin dependent and is perhaps mediated by a process that is caveolin dependent. So on the basis of this finding, our view of the route by which GAG reached its plasma membrane or multivesicular body steady state accumulation, at least in 293 T cell, is that the majority of GAG is targeted to the plasma membrane where the majority of assembly and release is occurring. Concomitantly, there is some targeting of GAG to multivesicular body, but the accumulation of viral particle in this intracellular compartment is mostly the result of an internalization process that is clatrin independent. So we think that the extent of internalization of viral particle in the MVBs, at least in 293 T cells, will be really a result of a ratio between the efficiency by which the virus is released and will depend also on the ability of cells to internalize virus from the cell surface toward MVBs. So the next question that we asked was, what are the host cell factors that control the site of viral assembly and budding? And we turned our attention to MHC class II molecules. MHC class II molecules are expressed in antigen-presenting cells, and their role is to present antigenic peptide to CD4 T cells. These molecules are heterodimers consisting of an alpha chain and a beta chain, and each of these chains consists of an extracellular domain, a transmembrane portion, and a cytoplasmic tail. There is several evidence indicating that MHC class II molecule interact with HIV during infection. In fact, HLA-DR is incorporated in HIV particle, as shown by the work of Michel Tremblay in Quebec City. HIV-NEF protein modulates MHC class II surface expression, leading to an accumulation of MHC class II in multivesicular bodies. But what got our attention was a report from Jack Nieuwenhuis' lab in Amsterdam showing that MHC class II molecules could induce the formation and maturation of endocyting MHC class II-like structure endogenous to MDB in 293 T cell in a process that strictly relies on the presence of the cytoplasmic tail and the transmembrane region and the transmembrane domain. So Andres Finzi and Yang Zhao in my lab started a project to determine whether MHC class II molecule could relocate HIV GAG from the cell surface to intracellular compartment in 293 T cells. Indeed, when we using immunostaining experiment, when they looked for GAG in cells where that were not expressing HLA-DR, the GAG immunostaining was cytoplasmic and was broad and diffuse. Upon expression of MHC class II molecule in 293 T cells, we saw a drastic relocation of GAG in punctuate structure that looked like internal vesicles, and these vesicles co-stain with HLA-DR. A expression of a mutant of HLA-DR that had a deletion of the cytoplasmic tail of the alpha chain and beta chain called and I'll be referring to this mutant as the TMTM mutant. This mutant didn't at all cause a relocation of GAG in this internal compartment. Being able to quantitate GAG localization, we were able to show that almost 50% of, in presence of HLA-DR, 50% of the cells showed a punctuate staining of GAG in those internal vesicles, whereas in control cells or in cells expressing the TMTM mutant, the majority of cells showed a broad diffuse staining of GAG. We next examined the nature of the compartment in which GAG was relocated in presence of HLA-DR, and in fact showed that this compartment was corresponded to multivesicular bodies, since this compartment were LAMP1 positive, CD63 positive, and LBPA positive. This result was also confirmed using electron microscopy experiment that showed that when HLA-DR was expressed, cells were displaying large intracellular vesicles in which both mature viral particle as well as assembling viral particle were present. In cells that were DR negative, or in cells that were expressing the TMTM mutant, HIV-1 assembly and release was strictly limited to the plasma membrane. As expected, this relocation of GAG to internal compartment in presence of HLA-DR led to a decrease in the HIV-1 release efficiency. In fact, when HLA-DR was expressed, we had a threefold decrease of HIV-1 release efficiency, whereas when the TMTM mutant, there was absolutely no effect on release, on viral release efficiency. Finally, we wanted to determine if this relocation of GAG in presence of class II molecule was part of a normal pathway of viral production, of infectious viral production, and was not a dead end where virus was not infectious. So we analyzed the infectivity of viral particles that were accumulating in intracellular compartments in presence of HLA-DR. So to do that, we took DR-expressing cells, let them produce virus during 24 hours, in order to accumulate virus in internal compartments. We then treated those cells with a protease inhibitor, endinavir, during 24 hours to inhibit the infectivity of all virus that was subsequently produced. After 24 hours, cells were lysed, and infectivity was measured using a MAGI assay. in condition where cell lysis efficiency was similar across all the samples, we found that the infectivity that was associated to cell that were expressing DR and were treated with the protease inhibitor, this cell-associated infectivity was 4 times more important than in control cells that were also treated. Consistent with this result, we detected an increased amount of mature P24 in DR-positive cells as control in cells that were in the control cells, indicating that HLA-DR promote intracellular accumulation of viral particle that still maintain their infectivity. So for sake of time, I won't go through the conclusion of the first part since I went through them already. In the second part of the talk, I showed you that HLA-DR expression promotes HIV-1 accumulation to MVB by a process that strictly relies on the cytoplasmic tail of the alpha and beta chain of classical MHC class II molecule. Intracellular virions produced in presence of HLA-DR remain stable and infectious despite the very harsh acidic environment that exists in this multivesicular compartment. This result indicates that the stable sequestration of infectious virion within cytoplasmic compartment may represent an additional mechanism of viral persistence in HIV-1 infected individuals. Overall, this result also suggests that MHC class II molecule may represent a cellular determinant promoting HIV-1 accumulation into MVB in MHC class II expressing cells, such as macrophages, and we are currently investigating the effect of downregulating MHC class II molecule on the GAG localization and viral production in primary macrophages. Finally, given that this symposium is on the novel target and drug development, what are the implications for drug development? The formation and sequestration of virion into MVB, a compartment which plays a central role in the formation and function of immunological synapse, will protect HIV against the best neutralizing antibody and is likely to facilitate transfer of virus to target cells at a point at which they are the most susceptible to HIV infection. While it will be very difficult to access intracellular virus, a better understanding of MVB exocytosis may suggest ways with which MVB could be prevented from releasing their content or perhaps encouraged to deliver to lysosome where virus will be inactivated or degraded. However, given that MVB exocytosis is an essential host cell pathway, the challenge will be to identify an effective antiviral agent that specifically targets HIV interaction with the endocytic pathway without perturbing the normal host cell trafficking network. Finally, I want to acknowledge the people that have participated to this study. In my lab, Andres Finzi, Alexandre Antoine, Yang Xiao, Joanne Mercier, and our collaborator on the MHC Class II project, Jacques Thibaudeau and Alexandre Brunet. And I want to thank the funding organization that have funded the lab and these studies over the years. Thank you very much.
Okay, so we have a few minutes for questions for Dr. Cullen. We'll start right here at microphone number 2, please.
Bill O'Brien, Galveston, Texas. You nicely framed the issue of differences in the second half of the virus life cycle in T cells and macrophages, but you focused on 293 T cells. So you got a lot of information. Have you done any of this in primary cells, particularly macrophages?
So the reason why we started with 293 T cell was to establish the system. We are currently extending these studies to T lymphocyte and macrophages.
Thank you. Microphone number 2.
I'm interested regarding to the MHC DR molecular complex with the HIV GAG molecular. Did you do any kind of detailed study which portion of the MHC DR domain interaction with the GAG?
Okay. Clearly, ANV is not involved in this relocation because even if we use virus that do not express ANV, we still see the relocation of GAG to MVBs in presence of HLA-DR. Now, we didn't see or we didn't detect any interaction of GAG with HLA-DR. But I mean, the fact that we don't detect it doesn't mean that it's not happening.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Cohen.
Thank you.
Our third speaker is Dr. John P. Moore. Dr. Moore is a professor of microbiology and immunology of the Weill Medical College at Cornell University, New York City. He's a thoroughbred Oxford graduate, having received his bachelor, master's, master of philosophy, and PhD degrees from Oxford University. Dr. Moore has served as an Elizabeth Glaser scientist of the Pediatric AIDS Foundation and is the recipient of an unrestricted grant for infectious disease research from the Bristol Myers Squibb Foundation. He also holds a merit award from the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Dr. Moore's topic today is entry inhibition as models for microbicide development. Dr. Moore.
Thank you for that introduction. So I'm not talking about new drug targets today. I'm talking about the use of existing drug classes or inhibitor classes in a different way, in a non-traditional way, not to treat infection, but to try to prevent it by means of a topical microbicide. And a microbicide is an important arm of prevention science strategy nowadays because it's simply because it's needed. With the number of heterosexual transmissions that are occurring, particularly in the developing world, with 80% of new transmissions from heterosexual intercourse, the need for something particularly to block vaginal transmission is extremely obvious. And when you've looked that in South Africa, one woman in four now becomes HIV infected by the age of 22, that's a pretty serious issue. So a microbicide could reduce transmission and buy more time for making an effective vaccine. Ultimately, the answer to transmission is an effective vaccine, but we all know it's not an easy thing to do, and it'll be some years yet before that task is accomplished. So in the meantime, other prevention methods become center stage. Particularly for women to control their own protection is essential, because although we're all familiar with the ABC concept, most infections are spread by unprotected sex. Abstinence and faithfulness are not likely to protect married women or those who are sexually abused. Women often cannot ensure that men use a condom, and condoms are also contraceptive, and that means they can't be used when one of the desired outcomes is pregnancy. Instead, a microbicide could fulfill many of the prevention science gaps if one can be developed and applied properly. Now, a microbicide could be defined as a chemical entity that can prevent or reduce HIV transmission when applied at the site of entry to the body, be that vaginally or rectally. It's probable but not certain that an effective vaccine, vaginal microbicide, would also work when applied rectally. That's certainly an assumption, but there's no design strategy that differs at present for the two sexual transmission routes. It's whatever's being made for one route would be tested for another route. Now, a microbicide could be applied as a gel, cream, suppository, sponge, or vaginal ring that gradually releases active ingredient. But in the most common incarnation, it's a gel. Now, to be useful, a microbicide, in the end, has got to be safe, for obvious reasons, effective, also for obvious reasons, but it's also got to be affordable. Essentially, it's giveaway technology. It's something that would be priced in the cents per usage for the developing world. Something that costs, you know, $10 a use isn't going to be terribly practical. So it's got to be cheap. We always have to be aware of the need for affordability. And again, it's got to be acceptable because it's going to be used in a sexual setting. So anything that's sort of nasty or runny or smelly isn't simply going to be used. Now, that's a formulation issue that I'm certainly not going to address today, because I'm going to discuss experiments in the monkey model, and the monkeys, to be honest, aren't that choosy. But so what I'm going to focus on for the rest of the talk is microbicides that are based on entry inhibitors that are already in clinical trials as antiretrovirals, and because they may meet many and perhaps all of these criteria. They could be safe, because they'll have a lot of clinical profile, effective, which I'll demonstrate to you in the monkey model they can be, affordable, because we're talking about conventional drugs by and large, and acceptable is a formulation issue I'm not addressing. So the simple concept is preventing HIV from entering cells prevents it from entering the body and establishing an infection. I mean, an entry inhibitor stops the virus going anywhere. They're generally likely to be reasonably safe. As I say, they're likely to be affordable, some of them anyway. And there's good evidence of efficacy that I'll show you. Now, the kind of inhibitors that I'm going to review in this talk, the one that my project group is studying in the macaque model, include compound 167, BMS378806, T1249, and AMD3465 that are sort of being done for product development, trying to move towards clinical trials. And I'll also mention C52L and CD4IgG2 for experimental purposes. Most of the work we've done uses the R5 SHIV, SHIV162P3, a CCR5 using challenge virus. And in some studies, we're using SHIV89.6P, which is an X4 virus with perhaps some CCR5 usage. The small molecule CCR5 inhibitor, compound 167, was Marty Springer's project at Merck. It was being developed as a clinical candidate alongside Shearing Plough's and Pfizer's Maraviroc and Vicrovirox programs, but Merck abandoned it for clinical development, which was unfortunate for Marty, but it did mean good fortune to us, because it meant we could get a clinically relevant, high-quality, potent CCR5 inhibitor for macaque studies. So it's every bit as good a molecule as Maraviroc and Vicrovirox. Bristol-Myers' Rich Colonna's group has been developing attachment inhibitors, of which BMS378806 was the first in the family. It's no longer being developed clinically because it's been superseded by better compounds, but it meant that, again, we could have access to it. Now, this compound binds to GP120 and inhibits CD4 binding and subsequent conformational changes associated with co-receptor binding. It's active against both R5 and X4 strains, so it's not co-receptor restricted. We used in early studies that have now been published a GP41 fusion peptide, C52L, made by my colleague Min Liu at Cornell Medical School. This is very similar, related to T20 and Fuvitide Fusion, a licensed drug. It's clearly a peptide. Min Liu engineered it for expression in bacteria in an effort to make it somewhat cheaper than in Fuvitide. It blocks fusion by inhibiting late-stage conformational changes in GP41, and again, this is a broadly active tropism-independent inhibitor. We've since moved on to work with T1249 from Trimeris, which was the son of T20. It was Trimeris's next development stage in the Fusion and Fuvitide program. It works in the same way that C52L does. It's more potent in vitro and in vivo than Fusion, and was tested in clinical trials and showed to have substantial antiviral activity. So there's clinically relevant safety and efficacy data on it. But it's no longer being moved forward as an antiviral drug. And I'll mention briefly, and only briefly, Pro542, CD4IgG2, a tetravalent CD4-based fusion protein from Progenix, which binds to GP120 and blocks virus attachment. Now, that's a protein which puts it likely to be outside the affordable range in the kind of amounts we'd need to be used at, but we've used it as a research tool. But this is being developed as an antiviral drug by Progenix, and it's in phase two. And the CXCR4 inhibitor we're using is AMD3465 from Anomed, from Gary Bridge's program. That's a specific CXCR4 inhibitor with only activity against X4 viruses. It is similar to compounds that are in clinical trials as antiviral drugs to treat CXCR4 using viruses in infection. And it's a perfectly credible compound to use in microbicide studies. So we published at the end of last year, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time reiterating the details of work that was published 8 months ago now by a paper by Ron Veazey. the work on compound 167, BMS-806, and C52L. Now, the challenge virus, as I mentioned, is SHIV162P3, CCR5 using virus. The monkey model is the progesterone-treated monkey model, which thins the vaginal epithelium and renders the monkeys highly susceptible to infection. So it's a very stringent model. We put in a relatively high dose of virus compared to human transmission. The vaginal epithelium has been deliberately thinned with progesterone. All those exacerbate the risk of infection, which means your controls get infected and you can do the studies. But it does make the model stringent, so protection against it is not trivial to achieve. When we use compound 167 at 5 millimolar, we protected 8 out of 10 animals. BMS-806, same concentration, we protected 6 out of 8. GP41, C52 peptide to GP41, we protected 3 out of 5, which compared to 9 out of 9 gave statistically significant protection in each of the arms. We've since done a study unpublished with T1249, a dose-ranging study applying as T1249 at different concentrations to see where protection lies. It's the first experiment we did on this compound. We only had 2 animals per group, but no protection at 0 or at 0.01 megamil or 0.1, but both animals that got 1 megamil and 5 megamil were protected, so it's a titratable response, and we're now working to fill in the gap to see just how much can be used. This is 200 micromolar. On the scale that Trimeris make peptides, which is in the sort of, you know, tons a year range, this becomes a practical concentration for use in microbicide studies, so it's not out of the question in the affordability range. So we're refining the existing dose response curve to identify an IC50 for in vivo protection. We're going to test it against other challenge viruses, particularly the X4 viruses, to see what it should block there, but we want to test that. And we, again, want to test it in combination with other inhibitors for reasons that I'll come to in a minute. And then we need to develop a formulation and product development strategy, which is clearly not work that I'll be doing. That's work done by Trimeris and others. Now, the case for combination microbicides, in my view, is absolutely obvious and almost inarguable. It's the same as the arguments for using combinations for therapy. You do not use monotherapy. And for the same reason, it doesn't make a lot of sense to use monotherapy for a microbicide. Using combinations of inhibitors increase your breadth of coverage against divergent strains. And in the real world, that's an important issue. You reduce the probability of transmitting viruses resistant to any single inhibitor. And you, in several circumstances, particularly with the entry inhibitors, can generate genuine synergy. It's an overused term. It's often confused with additivity, but I mean genuine synergy, where two inhibitors reinforce each other's action and reduce the amount of compound. You create genuine dose-sparing effects. So these are the theoretical arguments that I think are very strong for combinations. We did this in the published VZ paper. 9 out of 9 control animals were infected. 21 out of 28 animals given one inhibitor were protected when we lump them all together. 16 out of 20 animals given 2 inhibitors were protected, and all 3 animals that we gave 3 inhibitors to were protected. So it's not, because we had such good protection with single inhibitors, it's not obvious the protection was increased by combinations, but I think it makes sense to use combinations. So overall in that study, we used 51 animals and protected 40 of them in a stringent model, so you can clearly protect macaques. We, in the real world, a microbicide shouldn't just be something that has to be used moments before intercourse. Women and men, if they use it rectally, may want to have some options in terms of timing. So how late after applying the inhibitor will protection still apply? We address this in the monkey model by doing delayed challenge experiments. So you add the inhibitor, and in this experiment you use the CCR5 inhibitor compound 167. You add the inhibitor and then delay the challenge for 0.5 to 12 hours. And you see that at half an hour, we protected 8 out of 10. 2 hours, 2 out of 3. Even with a 6-hour delay, we're still protecting 50%, and one of the animals was protected even after a 12-hour delay. So that says sustained protection might be possible. When that's plotted out in a time course, you can see a sort of smooth gradation with the half protection for the compound 167, about 6 hours. We did fewer animals with BMS-806, and the curve isn't as nice, but again, you can see that you can get sustained protection even over a 6-hour period, which I think is quite encouraging. We did a Hail Mary experiment, which which wasn't in the paper, but I think it's worth going over. We wanted to see, could you protect against multiple repetitive challenges? So we put the three inhibitors, compound 167, BMS-806, and C52L, all at the highest doses. We gave those to the macaques as a triple combination every day for 5 days, and then did a SHIV challenge every day for 5 days. So they got five consecutive daily high-dose challenges. And obviously all the controls got infected. Three out of the five inhibitor recipients got infected. Put that the other way, two animals were protected against five consecutive daily high-dose challenges, which I don't think is all that shabby given the stringency of the model. So I think that's encouraging for the real world and says if you pick inhibitor combinations and formulate them right, they could be effective. Now, we want to address whether an X4 virus can be blocked. R5 viruses, CCR5 using viruses, account for almost all infections. At least the viruses that expand in the new host are CCR5 using. But CXCR4 using viruses can be transmitted, and I don't think we should neglect it. So we wanted to see whether vaginal transmission of a CXCR4 using virus can be inhibited. Rightly or wrongly, and I have a horrible feeling it's going to turn out to be wrongly, we chose SHIV89.6P because of its extensive use in the vaccine model. Now, that can use CCR5, CXCR4, and various other GPCRs in cell lines. But in primary macaque or human PBMC, it's only sensitive to CXCR4 inhibitors and is completely unaffected by CCR5 inhibitors. So in PBMC, which, of course, is not necessarily relevant to transmission events, it's an X4 virus. We also couldn't find any viral load reduction when we dosed a macaque with a CCR5 inhibitor. Now, it certainly uses CXCR4, but it's possible that it does use CCR5 under in vivo conditions, and that needs to bear in mind when looking at the next results. So we've used the Anamed AMD3465 compound, and essentially we haven't gotten protection with it. And AMD3465, 8 out of 10 animals were infected compared to 8 out of 9 controls. Compound 167, the CCR5 inhibitor, 3 out of 5. When we put both together, 1 out of 2. So we haven't exactly achieved protection against the X4 challenge virus with a CXCR4 inhibitor. The question we're addressing in the next series of experiments is whether the problem there is the inhibitor, which simply doesn't work, or the virus, which is not blockable by a CXCR4 inhibitor. So, this is an inhibitor that should work. It works well in vitro. It should bind the receptor well in vivo. But the possibility is that SHIV89.6P uses both CCR5 and CXCR4 for transmission, so that blocking neither receptor by itself is going to do the job. So this 1 out of 2, we're going to obviously expand into a large number of animals. We're also going to test a much purer CXCR4 using SHIV KU1, not KV2, it's SHIV KU1, and we also need to work on formulation issues. Now, the X4 SHIV can be inhibited, can be blocked. When we did BMS 806, we protected 1 out of 2, which is not significant. C52L, though, protected both animals, the GP41 peptide, and the combination protected both animals. So all four recipients of the GP41 peptide were inhibited. So I would say that we can block this challenge virus with an inhibitor that is co-receptor independent. The CD4 IgG2 molecule also protected all three animals that we challenged with SHIV89.6P. So again, we can block this virus, just not with the CXCR4 inhibitor, at least not yet. What we want to do when we've got a CXCR4 inhibitor working is a dual challenge experiment. So we want to apply an R5 virus and an X4 virus, whatever the X4 virus is we finally choose. We want to apply them as a mixed inoculum and see then if we can block broadly tropic viruses in a mixture, which is what happens in the real world. I mean, you don't use a single clonal virus. Women and men will encounter diversity of viral swarms. So we want to mimic this by putting in two viruses deliberately and measure the outcome of infection using a discriminatory viral load assay based on RT-PCR that will detect each virus independently. So that's what we're working towards, and we can also use the method for blocking two R5 viruses. And Steve and Kevin have put together a pretty neat assay based on detecting the ONS genes of either virus or the GAG gene of both of them to allow quantitation of the additive of the both of them together. And the assay works extremely well. We used it to measure viral load changes in dual-infected macaques treated with a CCR5 inhibitor a couple of years ago in a paper by Walensky et al. So the methodology there. The first experiment we did on this, five Chinese macaques challenged vaginally with SHIV162P3 and SHIV89.6P. One was uninfected. One was infected only with the R5 virus. The other three were dual infected, although in one the R5 viral load was transient. So we've still got to work on this to get more consistent infection, or else we'll need to up the control group significantly. So I'm going to switch to some in vitro research to wrap up, because a microbicide needs to be effective against all circulating HIV strains. As I said to you earlier, it doesn't matter if it just protects one challenge virus in the monkey. That's a big deal, no big deal. The global diversity of the HIV sequence is a very significant challenge for any microbicide, exactly the same way as it is for a vaccine. A vaccine needs to deal with broadly divergent viruses. So does a microbicide in the real world. And you can't assess this properly in the monkey model. There are only a limited number of challenge viruses. But it has to be assessed in cell culture systems using panels of test viruses, just as are being set up to analyze the in vitro potential of antibody-based vaccines. And John Mascola and Vicky Polonis' group and David Montefiore have established vaccine test panels for neutralizing antibody-based vaccines, and we've adapted them for our own use. So here we've tested three inhibitors at relatively high concentrations, compound 167, BMSC, which is a sort of son of BMS-806, and C52L peptide. Tested alone against a panel of, I think it's 30 viruses, they get essentially 100% blocking, a bit down for BMSC, so they're broadly active against all the viruses in the test panel from all the genetic subtypes. Obviously, in the double combination, the triple combination, we're getting 100% hit, so we're getting breadth of activity against all the viruses from all the subtypes. When we drop the concentrations down 1,000-fold to give it a more stringent test, the single compounds are only hitting 10 to 30%, but when we put double compounds in together, the protection rate in vitro increases, and when we put all three in, it increases a bit more. So this, again, speaks that combinations will act better against divergent viruses, because it means if you miss one virus, the other inhibitor might get it. So how are we going to move these into clinical trials? Well, of course, I'm not, because I'm not a clinician. It's not the kind of work I do. So agreements were established between the IPM, the International Partnership for Microbicides, Merck and Bristol-Myers Squibb, to develop their compounds, the company's compounds, as microbicides using Gates Foundation funding. And that would be done on a basis of the compounds being done on a free giveaway basis for the developing world, but the company is retaining licensure for any use in the future in the developed world, which can afford to buy them. Studies on compounds with greater potency and breadth of activity are in progress. I've shown some of them. And obviously, then suitable formulations need to be made, which will test for efficacy in macaques, and then one assumes the IPM clinicians will test them for safety in women. So I'd like to thank the program project team that has done this work, and particularly Ron Veazey, who's done all the primate research. Robin Shattuck, Melissa Pope, and PJ Klasser are the intellectual powerhouses of this team. And Kevin Kuntzman and Steve Walensky have developed the viral load assay. And all the people whose compounds I've mentioned, Marty Springer, Min Liu, Rich Colonno, Gary Bridger, Bill Olson, and Mike Greenberg, really deserve a lot of credit as well as thanks for having the vision to think in their company environments of doing something outside the box. These are people who've been developing drugs for drug use, traditional pharmaceutical industry work. Well, they're thinking laterally and thinking, can my drug, my company's drug, be used for prevention, which I think is very laudable. The NIH has funded this through a program project, and Bristol-Myers has funded work with their compound. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I know that some are rushing off, but we do have a few minutes available for questions for Dr. Moore. Perhaps I could just ask everyone as they head out to offer one last round of applause for our presenters, and thank everyone for their participation.